I want to welcome you to this program on how health reform might affect rural America. And I offer that welcome on behalf of Senator Rockefeller and Senator Collins and our board of directors. You know, some of us in urban areas lose sight of the fact that there are 50 million Americans living in rural areas, and those rural areas are, as opposed to the stereotype some of us have in our minds, far from idyllic in many ways. They have higher rates of poverty than urban areas, faster rates of job loss during the recession, bigger share of the population uninsured, and far fewer doctors and other providers to deliver the care in the first place. Now, there are some innovative and creative models dealing with these problems by using current programs and structures for delivering quality care at affordable cost in rural areas, and we need to be able to build on those models. And those with an interest and an expertise about rural areas and the members of Congress who represent those areas are looking very carefully at the possible rural impact of the pending reform proposals. There's a lot of interest in coverage expansions, in delivery system improvements, in information technology growth, just to mention a few. And speaking of health IT, most people here know that there was a major infusion of funds into HIT as part of the stimulus package, and there's a lot of attention being paid to how that money's being utilized and how rural areas are being affected. And I should say that Senator Rockefeller and Senator Collins are both personally keenly interested in this topic. They've been urging us to pursue a briefing on this topic for some time. And so we're doubly thankful to our co-sponsors and partners in this program, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for helping make it possible. The foundation has a very strong and continuing interest in these issues, working, as they say, to help Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. And we're very pleased to have, representing RWJ today, Brian Quinn, who's a program officer in the Foundation's Research and Evaluation Unit, as well as in the Synthesis Project. And by the way, if you haven't discovered the written products of the Synthesis Project, you really ought to. They are the most readable renditions of complicated research questions that you're going to come across. So, Brian, thank you for being with us, and thanks to the Foundation for their support and help in putting this program together.
Well, thank you, Ed, and thank you to the Alliance for Health Reform for putting this event on. The timing truly couldn't be better for such an important topic. As Ed indicated, we at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation are committed to helping all Americans live healthier lives and to get the care they need, no matter where they live. Yet we know there are disparities in access and outcomes that do depend on where people live, and Americans in rural communities often face disproportionate barriers with respect to finding good care and good health. Over the last couple of years, we've really focused our efforts and resources at the Foundation on trying to support research and policy analysis to provide policymakers here in Washington with the type of information they can use as they wrestle with reforming our health care system. And we're proud to have supported the work of Keith and his colleagues at RUPRI. Their presentation today, I think, really underscores some of the unique challenges facing rural populations, and it also demonstrates how people living in rural America have much to gain from a reformed healthcare system. And while we believe that expansions of healthcare coverage, should be a real cornerstone of healthcare reform, the Foundation also has broader interests in improving the health and healthcare of all Americans. We know coverage alone won't fix all of the problems in our ailing system. And so I'm happy that as part of today's discussion, we'll also be talking about HIT and deploying the workforce in a different way to look at some different models of care delivery. So again, I really look forward to the discussion today. Thank Ed and all his colleagues for putting it on, and thank all of you for joining us.
Great. Thank you, Brian. Let me just do a little riff on logistics here. Monday, you're going to be able to watch a webcast of this briefing on KFF.org, which we're very grateful to the Kaiser Family Foundation for doing. You'll find copies of the materials in your packets at that website, along with our own website at allhealth.org. There'll be a transcript available on our website within a few days after that. And I would point out that there are biographical data on our speakers in your materials that are far more extensive than you're going to hear out of any of the mouths of the moderators today. And I would point out that at the appropriate time, you'll find some microphones that you can use to ask your questions. There is a green card in your materials that you can fill out and have us ask your question for you. And that there is a blue evaluation form that we'd ask you to fill out before you leave so that we can improve these programs and make them more useful to you than ever. So, enough of the preliminaries. We have an extremely capable lineup of speakers for you today, and we want to get right to it. As Brian mentioned, we have leading off for us Keith Mueller, who's a professor of health services at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. He's director of RUPRI, I'm getting used to that, the Rural Policy Research Institute. He's a former president of the National Rural Health Association. He's testified a number of times, you may have seen over the last few months, on reform as it relates to rural areas, and is one of the authors of the brand new publication that just came out within hours of our briefing that summarizes some of the rural concerns in health reform. Keith, thanks very much for coming a long way. I hope you beat the snowstorm that's beating down the interstates in Nebraska.
Yes, it's fortunately it'll stay a little bit west of us. I'm on the eastern edge in Omaha. I'm going to very quickly this afternoon summarize the highlights of what's in the document in your packet. Point out initially that it is written by a panel in the biographies of everybody in the panel, including a guest author that helped us with this publication, are in the back of that document. Start with the question, why does rural need health reform? What's different and distinctive about rural? And this slide really tells the story, that the more remote one is in the United States, the higher the likelihood of being uninsured. So you can see that 23% of those who reside in communities of less than 2,500, 21% of those who reside in counties not adjacent to any urban area are uninsured, as compared to 19% in urban America. So higher rates of uninsurance as you move out geographically from the urban environment. Some specific rural situations, excuse me, that contribute to that higher rate of uninsurance. Rural adult residents are less likely to be employed in jobs where coverage is offered, 64% versus 71% in urban. They're more likely to be unemployed. 30% of the uninsured in rural are unemployed. In rural non-adjacent, that more remote area, again, includes a lot of self-employment, as you would expect in farming and ranching country, like two-thirds of my own state. And among those people who are self-employed, a higher percentage are uninsured in rural America than their counterparts in urban, 40 to 24 being the specific difference. Currently, when people in rural America are able to acquire insurance, there are some major sources that are important that over the last 5 years have actually narrowed that gap between rural and urban uninsured rates. One of those for rural adults and children is a higher rate of insurance coverage from public sources, including Medicaid, and especially in the last few years, the state children's health insurance plans have made a major difference in coverage in rural America. Expansions of Medicaid coverage for children over the last decade reversed previous urban-rural disparities in health insurance coverage. Rural children currently have the lowest uninsured rate. And we illustrate graphically for you the sources of insurance coverage in rural so you can really see a higher percentage of coverage in the public plans than in the private plans. And again, in those rural non-adjacent areas, a higher percentage with no coverage at all. Now, as we turn to reform, the question then is, how is this addressed in some of the provisions that are being discussed? And at the time we prepared what you're going to see now as analysis, of course, it preceded yesterday's introduction of a single House bill. So we used an amalgamation of the committee reports that had come out and used some fundamental building blocks that are described in more detail in the written document to produce a simulation of numbers that will tell us what the impact would be. So if you look at that amalgamation of coverage ideas, you get these results, that you would reduce the number of uninsured by 6.2 million individuals in non-metropolitan areas, leaving 1.9 million uninsured and a coverage rate then of about 96% in rural areas. The approach to covering the uninsured in those specific ideas that have been discussed would actually leave a smaller percentage of rural Americans uninsured as compared to urban, 4% rural, 6% urban. Now, why does that happen? If we look at some of the specifics of what we used in the simulation model, a slightly lower portion of previously uninsured in rural areas would come in through a health insurance exchange in comparison to urban, 49.8 versus 51.6. A higher proportion, and this is consistent with that pattern of recent expansion of coverage, would obtain coverage through Medicaid because their income falls below 133% of the federal poverty line. As I said, this predates yesterday's bill, which is 150%. But lower incomes in rural areas means a higher take-up under the Medicaid provision. A smaller portion would be children that obtain coverage through public programs, Medicaid, or CHIP. Those have been successful already. Of those obtaining coverage through the exchanges, a higher proportion of rural persons would do that through the assistance of a government subsidy, the numbers on the screen. The remaining persons in rural areas would pay full cost of the premium through an employer or individually. Of particular importance, then, to assuring access to comprehensive coverage in rural places are provisions of guaranteed issue, forbidding denial of pre-existing conditions and health status as a component of premium rating, and requiring assurance of continuous coverage. Limiting rating to four factors limiting the total range allowed is helpful to rural residents who otherwise may have paid higher premiums because of their health status being lower in rural than it is in urban. Important to rural considerations are issues of access. You'll hear more from Dr. Irons about access to healthcare professionals. This slide is access to insurance options. The exchange would be particularly important for rural residents because there's a higher prevalence of individual and small business health insurance market in rural than there is in urban. Since rural people have relatively lower incomes, individuals and businesses are more likely to select the basic plan. So that plan's premium cost and benefit structure are really important to what's going to become available and likely purchased in rural America. And rural residents would benefit from new limits on out-of-pocket expenses and elimination of the lifetime benefit maximum. In addition to lower incomes, rural residents suffer more from chronic disease and disability. So those limits on personal expenditure become really critical in rural areas. Rural people have less access to the internet and less experience enrolling in insurance plans, logically coming out of those earlier numbers of the higher rate of uninsurance and everything that we know about access and use of the internet, and Neil may talk more about that in the context of health information technology. Thus, the options for rural enrollment are going to require some rural relevant options, that is, where's the point of entry where I can get in and sign up for plans, and outlets. So how the information is presented, relying on websites is insufficient. There needs to be direct access to information through, and in the experience of the Medicare Part D program, places like Area Agencies on Aging in that program, and they could be helpful here too. Places of the faith communities have been helpful, again, with Part D, could be helpful here. Any civic organization that reaches out, I'm amazed as I travel throughout the rural part of my state of the presence, for example, of Lions Clubs and Veterans Clubs. Those are places where we could reach the people who will need this information, present it to them in ways other than just website access. We need to assure affordable access to medical care, which means access standards in the legislation will be very important. It's not good enough to have insurance plans available. We need to have access standards about the providers with whom those plans have created networks. to be sure that they are using the local primary care providers as part of their network coverage. We know from our research at the Rupri Center that's not always the case. If you look at programs even like FEHBP that is so popular, the number of choices dwindles rapidly if you say the choice has to be using the local primary care provider. So that needs careful monitoring as we move toward finishing language and looking toward implementation. On affordability, the subsidies to individuals and households to purchase the basic benefit are critical because of the income in rural areas. The cost of premiums could still be beyond the means of small employers with a low to moderately employed workforce. Therefore, tax credits are critical as a means of making insurance coverage affordable. Purchase of higher value insurance in rural areas will benefit providers who currently operate on very thin margins. The point here is the more often that a patient coming in to see a rural primary care provider is adequately covered with insurance, the more often that provider will be collecting their full charges and capable of remaining there as a provider without going financially out of business. So things like coinsurance and deductibles become important considerations as well. Individual and employer responsibility. Given the strong relationship between insurance coverage and health, the individual mandate should have a positive impact on the health of rural Americans and contribute to the finance package that comes with this legislation in its final form. Small businesses are more prevalent in rural areas, so crafting provisions related to employer participation will have a substantial effect on the extent to which insurance reaches the market. Public program eligibility expansions. From the earlier slides, you could see why those are important. So Medicaid expansions have a greater relative impact in rural than in urban. Rural citizens are more likely than urban to rely on Medicare and Medicaid as primary sources of coverage. And over the last decade, from the earlier information, you saw the impact of Medicaid expansion in rural America. So there are a number of core provisions that I've summarized that are important to rural. In particular, it all begins, as I said at the start, with the data that show the higher percentage of uninsurance in rural America combined with lower income and higher prevalence of chronic conditions. So, thank you.
Great. Thank you, Keith. Thanks very much, Keith. We're going to turn now to Dr. Tom Irons, who's a professor of pediatrics at the Brody School of Medicine at East Carolina University. And he's also really the driving force behind and the medical director of the Jim Bernstein Community Health Center, which provides care and educational programs for the people in its area. That center is part of one of the most comprehensive and extensive networks providing quality and patient-centered care for Medicaid beneficiaries that I know of. And Dr. Irons also founded Health Assist, a program for low-income and uninsured people in eastern North Carolina. We're happy to have you with us, and do your Oprah Winfrey imitation, Dr.
Thank you, Ed. I'm really loud, too. I apologize, but that, at least I can perhaps hold the microphone a little further away. Good. I give some of my colleagues headaches, and my wife a chronic headache. I gave her a big one this morning when I called her up at 6:15 and said, please, please get out of bed and come bring me my telephone at the airport, which she did in her pajamas. I shouldn't say that in a webcast, should I? And this is what it's like to live in eastern North Carolina. The TSA man went out front and waited for my phone for me and then brought it to the plane so that I could leave. All right, here we go. Our vision in North Carolina, was of a coordinated system of care for Medicaid and uninsured care recipients that would improve the quality of that care and control costs at the same time and do it on our own. And many of you are familiar with Community Care of North Carolina and what it has accomplished so far, doing it on our own with a state-run network with a lot of volunteer work from physicians. Jim Bernstein, for whom the Jim Bernstein Center is named, was the visionary behind this dream. He and Dr. Alan Dobson really came up with the notion of this network. And Jim had a broader vision, a vision of expanding this same model of service and care to uninsured people and ultimately expanding that coverage. None of us dreamed that we would even be this close, and God knows how close we really are, to health care reform at this point. Jim was the founding head of the North Carolina Office of Research, Demonstrations, and Rural Health Development at that time. Now it's the North Carolina Office of Rural Health and Community Care. Jim was also visionary in making that office the seat of the reorganization of health delivery of primary care health services across North Carolina. What the community care of North Carolina is a state-run, state-coordinated Medicaid care management system. We operate physician-led community networks that assume the responsibility for managing recipient care. We are highly focused on quality and utilization and cost-effectiveness. We have to create significant close partnerships between hospitals and public health departments and providers and so forth and community health centers in ways that that hasn't been done before and, in fact, in ways in which forces tend to operate in the opposite direction. Just very, very quickly, in a real gloss over, this community care of North Carolina is financed with a per member per month that's paid to the provider, a matching per member per month that's paid to the network. And what does the network do with that money? The network provides the care management and the coordination of the system. For age, blind, and disabled patients, there's a significant increase, about a double in the per member per month that has been paid. That's a much more difficult nut to crack and to deal with than to deal, say, with asthma management in children and getting children on asthma care plans. What we can show is that in 2008, last year, our estimated savings in the age, blind, and disabled area alone were on the order of $400 million. That's a Mercer consulting a number. I want to tell you what we have done, the Eastern North Carolina version of what we have done is to form an independent 501c3 that we call Access East Incorporated. I chair the board of Access East Incorporated. Access East houses and operates the community care plan of Eastern North Carolina, but also our uninsured care project, Health Assist, which was originally an HCAP project. If you've been around long enough, you remember those. And later on in its second iteration, a CAP project, and now a part of what we call North Carolina Health Net that's funded with a very, very few, a very much smaller number of dollars that come from the state level. Access East also decided to build and own this model community health center structure, the James D. Bernstein Community Health Center, which was named in Jim's memory. Jim died in June of 2006. We also leased back that center to a federally qualified health center, Greene County Healthcare, Inc., a very fine one operating out of Greene County, North Carolina, right adjacent to us. And they leased back East Carolina University, my employer, which operates our indigent pharmacy because they happen to do a good job of it. And the community college of our county actually leases a significant portion of our building and operates an ongoing basic skills educational structure all in the same place. Let's go then and look at community care plan of Eastern North Carolina. It's a big, big place geographically. I live in Pitt County, right there in the middle. Out to the northeast, things are pretty doggone bad. They are not anything like your pictures of the Outer Banks of North Carolina or Duck, NC, I can tell you that. We use, of course, a standard case management system with the nurse case manager being at the hub, the primary care provider at the top, the patient at the bottom, and then all the coordination with all the other people who might be involved in some way to improve the health of the patient. That nurse case manager touches and helps manage a select population of the overall population that, in general, she will manage. We serve 27 counties. We have over 165 providers, and we are well over 100,000 enrollees in this very large geographically dispersed program. Layered onto this is our Health Assist Project and the Bernstein Center. The Health Assist Project aims to do uninsured care management based on the same operating principles as community care of North Carolina. Good, low-budget case management, as low as we can make the budget, a primary care medical home, medication assistance, access to specialty care, and lots of just dealing on that. How many will you give us this year, and how much money will you, the radiology practice, allow this year? Will you write off? Will it be $60,000? It's up to $70,000 this year in our project. And that thing I like to brag about, and that is our community basic skills education. Well, that is the front of the Bernstein Center, which is just a picture of a building. But it has a what it has in it, this is our medical wing. On the right side is our education wing. On the left side is our dental clinic, where we have eight dental chairs and two full-time dentists operating. On the back is a pharmacy. And they're all tied together as a real community development effort, not simply as a community clinic. Informally, however, like my grandchildren on the front porch down on the Pamlico River, we have a different structure, and this is very important. It's called the North Carolina, the Eastern North Carolina Community Health Consortium. Once a month, a group of people sits down at the table together informally. Okay? Access East is at that table. Community Care of Eastern North Carolina is at that table. Our Health Assist team and project leaders are at that table. Greene County Healthcare, as its own independent entity, is at that table. Our hospital health system, public health, county medical society, outside county medical societies, university, division of social services, even transportation services. And here's the trick. We do this astonishing thing, this novel approach. We include in all the meetings with equal voices not only those who direct the work, but those who do it. So the person who has to figure out how to make the appointments for specialty care is at the table with those who decide how it's all allocated out, helping us figure out how to do it right. Isn't it novel to listen to the people who actually do the work? Rough numbers, we're a medical home for over 20,000 uninsured patients. We have about 1,600. That's Greene County Healthcare, Inc. We have about 1,600 enrolled in Health Assist for additional services and about 600 actively receiving services at any given time. We get a substantial amount of money from HRSA through the Community Health Center and from a new network formed in North Carolina called NC Health Net, which is entirely state dollars. That's a couple of $100,000 a year and a lot of in-kind space and personnel and so forth. Well, what am I here to tell you? Here's what I've learned. The big problems are support staffing is thin. It is so thin, it is scary. You talk about lean management. Yeah, when I work and see patients, I've got one medical office assistant doing everything. And if I hadn't gotten my language skills up, I would really be in trouble because that person would also have to interpret if I happened to be seeing somebody who didn't speak English. Huge burden of uninsured rural adults with complex, preventable, chronic conditions. You open the door and you're flooded with patients who, if they had a medical record, it would be that thick. The entering the necessary data, here's one for you, Neil. Entering the necessary data into the electronic health record for one patient like this takes an average of 45 minutes for the provider to perform. 1 minute and 2 seconds. I'm getting down on my time. Our primary care demand instantly exceeds the capacity. And we have very large gaps in specialty services. I cannot get but one or two ophthalmologists in the entire area to see any of our patients who are uninsured. We have across our region a serious shortage of primary care providers with major in a region that has major social and educational and economic problems. We believe you have to design a system that wraps all of that together, and we believe it can be done. The healthcare system is fragile. It's very weakly linked. We have some institutionalized conflicts, let's say, between public health and community health that get in the way significantly all over the region. I'll cite you two examples. The first one is Tyrrell County with the big arrow there. The second is Hyde County. And you're just a hop, skip, and a jump across the sound from the beautiful Outer Banks of North Carolina in two counties that do not have a doctor at all, where the health status of population is terrible, where the uninsured care rates are the first and second highest in North Carolina. Okay. There's a nurse practitioner in each of those counties operating in a medical clinic. Both of those nurse practitioners report directly to me. If they didn't report directly to me at no cost, they would not be able to keep their clinics open. They couldn't afford it because they couldn't afford to have a supervising physician, and they certainly can't afford to recruit a physician. So that's a couple of examples of the seriousness of the problem. What do we need? We need a real safety net. We've got to have it. Whatever reform does, if there isn't a fallback for those people so that they have to get enrolled and they can enroll in something, we've got no way to control this. We've got no way to control these costs or to help anybody. And that includes things like premium subsidies and incentives for partnership creation and primary care recruitment and retention. incentives from medical student education all the way to community practice. You can't just stop with educating medical students to go into rural practice because they've got to do residency. And you've got to have incentives that are tied all the way down the line to make them want to do what we need them to do, what our workforce needs. We need to create innovative team-based models of care that involve nurse practitioners, behavioral health professionals as well. We use an integrated care model in the Bernstein Center. Or you can just go and paddle your canoe on the Pamlico anytime you want. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dr. Irons. We'll take it out of your question and answer time.
I promise, Lisa, I wouldn't do that.
Well, we would take it out of your honorarium, but you know what that would do. Our final speaker is Neil Neuberger. He's the first executive director of the Institute for eHealth Policy, which in turn is part of the Healthcare Information and Management Systems Society Foundation. Did I get all the words in the right order?
Yeah.
That's why they call it HIMSS, so you don't have to say all that. Now, many of you may know him for his role in coordinating a very long and distinguished series of lunchtime briefings on the Hill. There's a good idea. On telehealth and healthcare informatics. And he's a veteran of the Hill himself, having worked for Congressman David Obie, who's a force in the House Appropriations Committee and has been for years. And, Neil, we're very pleased to have you on our panel. I don't think this has ever happened before, even though we've had a long and distinguished relationship.
It has not, and the relationship has gone the other way, and we're glad to be collaborating with Ed and the Alliance for Health Care Reform through our Hill series. We've had Ed on some of our programs, including at HIMSS in Chicago last winter, and I want to continue that collaboration. I didn't think I could talk as fast, that a Southerner could talk as fast as this boy from Chicago, but Dr. Irons just proved me wrong. So I'm going to whip through 25 slides, many of which you have. I've swapped out a few, so bear with me. You do have a much bigger slide set, and I won't be able to get through all those, but I'll leave those for you for your own information. Now, there are folks in this room who are from rural organizations. There are folks here from healthcare organizations. I know there are people here from HRSA. There are colleagues of mine here from the IT community, Gary Capistran, who's our executive director for the ATA's policy committee, of which I'm a chair of the American Telemedicine Association. My colleagues from HIMSS Institute for eHealth Policy, Wayne Humphreys, Rick Sherwood, and others. And so the trick here is to meld those three disciplines into some kind of coherent presentation having to do with rural, healthcare, and IT. And so let me see if we can do that a little bit. There are, as Keith said, tremendous gaps in rural health IT and in adoption as far as the Internet is concerned, depending on what studies you look at. Those gaps are now closing, but there are still significant differences. And if you were to look, for example, at the health affairs issue from October of this year, there's a new study out called Evidence of an Emerging Digital Divide Among Hospitals That Care for the Poor, many of those rural and obviously other underserved healthcare organizations and hospitals. We've got a long way to go in this country, notwithstanding the high-tech provisions, to get to an e-enabled healthcare environment. It is still very much true and will be for some time that I can pretty well walk into just about any kiosk ATM terminal in the world and stick this card in and find out that I have zero balance in my account, but I can't get my electronic record in a portable, consistently updated, transportable sort of way that makes some sense. Now, fortunately, a lot has happened just in the last few months, and we're going to talk a lot about that in the next 8 minutes and 45 seconds, and I'm going to breeze through some slides here. What's driving all this activity? Efficiency, access, public health, quality, the whole issue of reducing medical errors, the IOM's report from 10, 12 years ago about the 98,000 untoward deaths per year has a lot to do with implementing health information technologies effectively within the United States. Disasters in IT, lot of emphasis in, on it post-Katrina and some of the other natural and political disasters that we faced, long experiences in using telehealth and IT internationally for multilateral crises of various kinds, including in support of our troops overseas and for humanitarian assistance missions for many years, going back and good experiences from DOD and the VA along those lines, and for the personal health record or the PHR or consumer-driven health care. There are, as you would guess, numerous players in this field, if you through your offices aren't already aware of this, including Congress, the agencies, and it's not just for HHS anymore, nor has it ever been. Department of Commerce Technology Opportunities Program, Department of Ag's Rural Utility Services Program, DOD and VA, as I mentioned, NASA Division of Life Sciences and Microgravity Applications has done a lot over the years in IT. I used to do a lot of work with them. Federal Joint Working Group on Telehealth through HRSA has tried to make sense of it all across and among the federal agencies and is now codified in law as a result of HITECH. There are hundreds of statewide initiatives, literally probably thousands of bills related to HIT, some of which will complement and others not the HITECH provisions. There are statewide alliances and coordinating councils among the National Governors Association, through the Health Information Management Systems Society, and there are a whole series of private sector coalition consortia organizations like ATA, the eHealth Initiative, HIMSS, AHIMA, the HIT Now Coalition, former Senator Breaux and former Congresswoman Nancy Johnson, and some others. As Ed mentioned, we have our Capitol Hill series on telehealth and healthcare informatics, and there are lots of standards groups out there that are trying to vie their way into it. We're trying to figure out what will be the overriding standards group going forward as it relates to HITECH, and those are listed here, as well as a lot of the academic work that has preceded this effort through foundations like the Commonwealth Fund, RWJ, thankfully, Markle, the eHealth Foundation, and others. Now, more to the point, we coordinate a rural health IT coalition along with the Rural Health Resource Center in Duluth that Keith's group is a part of and others, and they've been focused for about the last 2 or 3 years on various initiatives just on rural HIT, and we also are a participant in a health information technology for underserved populations collaborative that's headed up by the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Minority Health, Dr. Garth Graham for DHHS. And so there are a lot of synergies between rural and underserved and minority HIT issues, and fortunately a lot of attention being paid to those right now in this current debate. The next slide just shows you a little bit about what's at issue, and I'll talk about that in the next slide, which is, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And so the number one, two, and three issue continues to be money, 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 or reimbursement and capital costs in our case. Many of the incentive-like provisions have been addressed, and we'll talk a little bit about that if I have time, through the HITECH bills. But what's left are some of the upfront capital investment kinds of strategies to get rural healthcare organizations especially to what's called meaningful use by 2011 so that they can begin to advantage those incentives, whether they're solo providers or hospitals or healthcare organizations. And that's what's at issue. Whole series of standards issues having to do with clinical inequality, infrastructure issues, and a lot of these are holdovers from our debates for many years on telehealth, okay? And that's why I say the more things change, the more they stay the same, because there are experiences and lessons to be learned, especially out of rural telehealth communities like East Carolina University's Brody School of Medicine's telehealth program, carrying forward into the HIT debate. Whole series of human dimension issues, liability issues, arrangements to practice at a distance, state-based licensure issues, which Congress will not step into and will have to be solved at some point. And then finally, and I should probably put this first, not last, the HIT workforce training issues. We know that we need as many as 40,000 rural HIT workers right now just to get ramped up to the incentive provisions in HITECH, and as many as 200,000 HIT workers nationally. So not only is there a health profession shortage in rural areas, there's an HIT workforce shortage, and we need to uptrain, cross-train, and more importantly, start to get those folks into the pipeline today so that they can come out in several years and help enact all of this. Okay, what are some of the challenges to rural? Some of them have already been mentioned by Dr. Iron and Keith Mueller. Patients may be isolated, travel long distances, rural residents and minorities may be older, cultural and language barriers, low patient volumes, longer wait times, disjointed care. Underserved populations have little or no IT support in most of these institutions or an IT department. It's hard to find administrative change agents. There are other business priorities like surviving. Why would they want to share data that is actually money going through those wires in the case of co-located or similarly located facilities that are otherwise competitors? Maybe they do around public health information, but not necessarily around clinical data and information. So the EMR is going to happen a lot sooner than health information exchange, especially in rural areas that are trying to survive, in my view. There's no aggregate buying power. It's hard to get vendor support, therefore. And the bottom line is that consumers and healthcare organizations are going to need special legislative consideration. Thanks to a lot of you in this room, there is that kind of consideration in the high-tech provisions. Now we just need to make sure it gets carried through and happens. Okay? Put positively, as Pogo would say, there are no problems, just insurmountable opportunities. I don't know how that got in there. Choose the right technology. Do not do science fair projects when you're a kid on lithic technology having to do with 200,000-year-old Paleolithic tools. When the guys on either side of you have wooden boxes with plexiglass fronts and a lot of wires in them, and can anybody guess what they were doing? The first PCs. This is in 1974 in Chicago. There's yours truly. They're all rich and in Silicon Valley, and I'm sitting here talking to you. And I enjoy it. And I enjoy it. $50 billion, that's a lot of money for high tech, okay? Like drinking water from a fire hose, and we better get it right. And there are many ways in which to approach the goals of the stimulus bill having to do with job creation, infrastructure build out, community economic development, especially in rural areas. Here's a little bit about the provisions. It is not $19.5 billion in Medicare incentive money. It is, as everybody knows, $36.3 billion over 10 years in budget authority and outlays, less $15 billion in projected savings for a net of $20.8. There are discretionary funds for the national coordinator in the amount of $2 billion, including grants to states, and I'll talk about that in if I have a little time in a second. There's $2.5 billion for infrastructure programs to community health centers and through HRSA programs, half of which could be used for IT. Much of that money has already gone out the door. Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality that impacts on it, and some other agencies. Some of the critical definitions are going to have to do with meaningful use, that is, meaningful adoption of HIT technologies to help organization to show that they're these things are actually going to be put into place, and that's the criteria upon which the incentive money will flow. Meaningful use of certified or qualified electronic healthcare records. We're also very concerned to make sure that telehealth is included in the definition of health information technology for purposes of high tech. There are provisions such that Medicare and Medicaid incentives and disincentives are available to hospitals for meaningful users. There's a base of about $2 million and an average payment of about $6 million per hospital. Critical access hospitals are different. If I have just another minute, Ed, I'll talk about that for a second. Medicare or Medicaid incentives are available to providers, and FQHCs have to serve 30% medically needy. All other individual providers and institutions need to show that they're actually serving 30% Medicaid patients, not just medically needy patients. And so there's a distinction there, but basically there's money for both. Now this chart, I just want to spend a minute on and I'll close. This is a HIMSS Analytics data that shows how far behind critical access hospitals are in getting to what's thought to be needed to start their first year of incentive payments in 2011. They need to get to stage four on a 7-point scale, okay? I'm only at stage two on my own 10-stage plan, but they need to get to stage four. 35% of hospitals, critical access hospitals, among 1,300 hospitals are at stage zero, okay? And only 1.1% or about 3% in aggregate are at stage four or above, compared to PPS hospitals that really don't fare all that much better if you look at the chart. This is a problem. This is a major, major ramp-up problem that Congress and the staff could not have foreseen, but it is in fact. And here's a little bit about critical access hospitals and how they would be paid and how they differ from the way in which PPS hospitals would be paid. And the big takeaway here is that undepreciated costs for the formula that they use would not count. So there is little incentive for them to get started ahead of time or become early adopters now, between now and, say, 2011, because they won't get those costs counted. And that's a barrier, okay, and something that we hope would get worked on. Just, we could talk more about that in questions. Just 10 seconds about some of the other provisions. There are a whole bunch of provisions. We've talked about this on regional extension centers and their concerns about how those would focus on rural state cooperative agreements. There are broadband grants that we need to look at through RUS and NTIA, safety net clinic provisions, research provisions, comparative effectiveness research money that goes to rural, the workforce issues, as I've mentioned, and changes in privacy and security to HIPAA. And then finally, and last but not least, there are a whole series of provisions or language provisions that would require various studies as it relates to rural underserved populations, aged populations, and the like. Last but not least, and we can talk about this, there are some provisions in the pending reform bills, both in the House and in the Senate side, and I can, if somebody asks me, talk a little bit about that in questions, but there are about 10 to 12 minor or miscellaneous provisions, some of them very important, however, to further implementation that we hope will find their way into the final bills as they move through Congress. And that's all I got. That's my story. I'm sticking to it unless somebody wants to challenge me, in which case I'll change my story and just agree with you. Thank you.
Well, we're not going to give you a chance to make him change his story. Or any of the other panelists change their stories or reinforce them. As I mentioned, there are microphones that you can use to rise and speak to our panel and direct a question to any or all of them. You can fill out a green question card and hold it up, and we'll bring it forward. If you do go to the microphone, we'd ask you to be as brief as you can so that we can accommodate as many folks and their questions as we can, and to identify yourself. Meantime, let me just start off by asking, let me start with Keith, I guess, as you were going through the recommendations in the RUPRI document, there was a fair amount of emphasis on Medicaid expansions and a recognition of the importance of the public programs as well. Are you worried at all that by expanding Medicaid, you're going to contribute to either access problems, that is, finding willing providers at Medicaid rates, or provider discontent if you don't raise them?
Two responses to that, Ed. One is you are taking a population that is currently uninsured, very low income, and so that when they do seek health care, we know they don't seek health care as often, and they tend to come in through emergency rooms even in rural areas. But when they do, there is little to no revenue associated with that patient encounter. So initially you have some advantage over status quo for the patients that you are seeing. Admittedly, you would get an influx of patients not currently coming in, because that's why we want to expand coverage. It may be important, therefore, to consider provisions like is in the House bill that was introduced yesterday, which also address Medicaid payment rate, to bring that closer to at least Medicare payment rate for the patients coming in. And the House bill includes some federal support to help accomplish that increase in per patient encounter revenue from Medicaid.
Tom, how difficult is it to get providers in your area, if you can find them, to accept Medicaid?
It's extremely difficult. Of course, at least in North Carolina, Medicaid has reimbursed pediatrics and obstetrics quite well over the last 15, 20 years, so we've not had the problem with those two specialties that we have with others. But when you get beyond those, it's extremely difficult to get people to accept those patients. And for dental services, which are a vital part of this, darn near impossible except in certain very restricted type of large volume environments where they specialize in doing Medicaid care, which usually occur in urban areas. So there's a very significant problem there. And, of course, for uninsured patients, that much greater. I think providers would clearly respond, would benefit clearly from an increase in Medicaid reimbursement, Medicare reimbursement. There's no question of that for their current patients. And it would improve their situation, but the overall situation can only be helped by covering those people who don't have anything and who happen to still be cared for.
And that actually leads to a question that somebody asked on a card before the program, which is something you just alluded to and showed a picture of, as a matter of fact, in the center, and that is how we might address the serious, what is described here as the serious shortage of dentists in rural area, dealing with the fact that families have to travel huge distances at high cost to receive care. Is there relief in the reform packages or are there things going on under the current Medicaid or SCHIP or indigent care provisions that might do something about that?
Well, if anybody has ever seen one of the shows or heard one of the radio reports on these clinics that go in and set up in rural areas and work 24 straight hours and see 500 people, you really get a sense of how bad it is. The dental hygiene of the patients that we see in those two counties, Hyde County and Tyrrell County, North Carolina, is absolutely horrible. And they've been neglected so long that they have major health problems in addition. It's going to take a lot. We're starting a dental school at East Carolina, and we've got an innovative model in mind to try to train people in rural areas. But it's as long as it is highly profitable to practice private dentistry and barely livable to practice public dentistry, we're not going to be able to get dentists.
Keith, did your work group talk about, consider the question of dentist shortages?
We considered it some in the context of really virtually all of the healthcare professions reaching over the next 10 years shortages, and we know the shortage will hit first and hardest in rural and last the longest there. There are two comments about that. One is innovative programs like Dr. Irons just mentioned in North Carolina. We've done some things in Nebraska and other states have as well to try to encourage those going through dental school, and especially with expansion in dental classes, to practice throughout the service area of that dental school. Ours is a couple of states. The other is, and this applies to a lot of different delivery modalities, is thinking about new ways of delivering the care. So what can we do with telemedicine, telehealth, communications to extend the dental professional capability beyond the urban areas where they practice? And we're doing some of that in Nebraska now. So dentistry is picking up some steam. So the reform legislation needs to include provisions that allow us to think of different ways of using telemedicine as an example to be able to extend services to places where we may not be able to get the professionals to locate.
We'll get to your questions in just a second. I just wanted to follow up, if I can, another question that someone had is evoked by what you just said, and that is simply how you measure health provider shortages in rural areas. What are the metrics? Are there some federal standards that are used, and how does it work?
Yes, there are federal standards. It's generally done on a professional-to-population ratio, and the expectation that there is a minimum, like one primary care provider to every 3,000 people. Then it gets adjusted a little bit for the composition of the population from there to actually designate someplace as a shortage area. You can also get designation as a medically underserved area or medically underserved population. And having given you three general categories, you can imagine there's a lot of numbers behind that, and I don't remember all of them. But those designations are out there, and you can get to those through the Bureau of Health Professions at HRSA.
Thank you. Yes. Want to identify yourself?
Bob Griss with the Institute of Social Medicine and Community Health. I have two related questions. One of them is whether states have any obligations to equalize access to health care, given the kind of standards of shortages that we're talking about. And secondly, it seems like we've been focusing on the deficiencies in rural areas, the comparative disadvantages that they have. And yet, I saw in Dr. Iron's overhead that there were lots of stakeholders around the table, providing at least an informal structure for coordination. It seems like there may be some real advantages that rural communities can bring to the table, not just in their own communities, but in the urban areas. And I'm wondering if states recognize what the comparative advantages are of rural areas, whether there might be some potential savings at the state level that could then be distributed in more equitable ways.
Bob, with respect to the first part of your question, you're talking about a legal obligation?
Yeah, like it could be a state constitutional requirement or maybe even a federal requirement that if you're taking Medicare dollars, you have to distribute them in certain equitable ways.
Well, in terms of actual distributing them in terms of equal access, I don't know of any regulation or any rule that has to be followed, and I have not seen most states take that responsibility. I think most of the efforts, even in a place like North Carolina, have come from innovative pockets where people have thought, well, we could do this differently. And I really think that this little informal model has really important implications. I've seen the same kind of model applied at the state level, and I wouldn't even tell what it was. I'd be afraid somebody would know about it, you know, where informally people sit down together and figure out how we – so if you give it formal structure, you ruin it, you know, and you figure out how somehow we can cobble together the resources and nobody feels vulnerable enough, so vulnerable as to withhold information or to stake out a position. It takes years to do this, though, and that's the biggest problem. To get this consortium to function properly took about 4 years and constant reinforcement of why are we here, why are we here. You even have a little mantra. You say, we'll do what's right, we do it well, we do it together. Just a little thing we say that keeps everybody kind of at the table. To begin to get them thinking and cooperating together. So it takes that kind of local effort. But states could learn to do that and disseminate it, and that's what we're working on now. We're working on a plan to do that in North Carolina.
For IT and telehealth, it doesn't happen without that kind of collaboration, and it doesn't happen without collaboration across the vertical markets that an IT or telecom provider may or may not be able to provide in any given rural area. And so we know that robust programs do not happen unless, you know, the local civic and community leaders are involved in an implementation. They tend to be the boards of directors of those hospitals or clinics that have boards of directors, you know, and they may come from farming or banking or wherever. But that's critically important. And there have been attempts federally to dampen the effects from the sort of top down. The FCC's USAC program from the Telecom Reform Act 12 years ago was an attempt to dampen the effect of line charges from rural areas for broadband line charges between their nearest urban counterpart and rural areas more than 50 miles away. Now, that was a Rockefeller snow provision, and it went variably well because it wasn't implemented all that well, and it didn't have the specificity in it needed, and now 10 years later there's additional thought being given to further changing that, possibly as part of reform, to make it more effective for rural areas. That was up to $400 million per year available to rural areas to come up with for help on their telecom line charges. So there have been those sorts of efforts also at sort of social, you know, almost, you know, figuring out how to deal with some of those disparities that exist, at least in our field.
Let me just add one thing, and I guess it should be coming from Brian instead of from me, but I just happened to have sat in on a program yesterday that was built around a program funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation called Community Partnerships for Older Adults, in which a dozen and a half communities around the country had exactly the same kind of informal conversations and collaborations that Tom Irons was describing about how one deals with frail and vulnerable older people. And those partnerships turned out to be very successful. There's a brand new publication that came out of that project that you might find on the Robert Wood Johnson website, and I think it might provide some useful ideas for how to proceed in a more general context like the one we're talking about here. Yes, go right ahead.
David Schulke, American Health Quality Association. Neil, I was really glad you mentioned capital costs, and it was implied, I think, in many other comments that it's really hard to afford to buy the hardware and software to move forward with HIT. Can you say what it is that's needed to adjust the policy enacted in ARA to make it more feasible for people to afford to buy for practices, clinical settings, to buy HIT? And related to that, would you agree it might be sensible to link that to their receiving assistance from the extension centers? Because there's a fair amount of evidence out there that people who buy the hardware and the software without assistance in planning and, you know, evaluating, buy stuff that they can't use and don't use it, and, you know, money is wasted. So if there's going to be loans for them or recognition of depreciation or any of those policies, might they be linked to the practices that take the time and trouble to get help from somebody who can really make it likely to succeed?
Yeah, absolutely. Good questions. And as you know, yesterday the House passed the SBA program. I forget the formal name of it, the financing bill. Overwhelmingly, you know, like 300 and something to 30, and that includes provisions that's to bridge loans, to provide loans to small group practices and clinicians to get them to the incentive provisions under HITECH, and I think it's up to $200,000 loans or something. So that's tremendous. That's exactly the sort of thing I think that should have to happen. Now, there's other loan authority through the Rural Utility Service in HITECH, through the Distance Learning and Medical Links program, that would also provide some loans, but they're not quite the same as SBA loans, and they cost more in the end. So RUS has always had more trouble getting its loans out there than I think SBA has its loans. That said, there's also private sector interest in doing exactly that kind of thing, and what we're seeing is a tremendous amount of leveraging of ARA HITECH provisions right now. And one of our fellows, and I don't have the memo in front of me, did a thing for me on all of the various companies that have stepped up to the plate and are providing funding one way or another. Either they're providing broadband funding, say in the case of AT&T, to the tune of like $17 or $18 billion, or in the case of some companies like GE Medical Systems and IBM and others, they're providing loans and upfront funding to help, obviously, to sell their own equipment. But be that as it may, they see this market as huge now, given the federal investment, and very many private sector companies are stepping up because they see those gaps. That's the front-end problem. The back-end problem is sustainability, and a lot of folks are worried about that also because there have been those problems in telehealth in rural areas over the years, and Dr. Irons' program is one of the ones that is long-lasting. There are many telemedicine programs that have come and gone in the 19 years I've been involved in this field. So we're all concerned about what happens after HITECH, after ARA.
And can I just ask, Neil, as long as you're on that topic, to what extent is there hesitation among people who are potentially acquirers of the hardware and the technology while some of the standards that you were describing are being developed?
Absolutely. There's hesitation because early adopters who may already be implementers of, say, an electronic medical record do not necessarily know that the equipment that they've purchased or the systems that they've integrated will be acceptable to whatever standards body, whether it's the Certification Commission for Health Information Technology that in the end does this, or the Health Information Technology Standards Panel, or whatever it's going to be. And so that is a big pause right there on the part of especially a lot of rural institutions who only ever had limited budgets to make purchases for these sorts of things. You know, so they scraped it together. They finally got their boards to go along with it, you know, 3-5 years ago or now. Did they do the right thing, and is that going to be acceptable for purposes of meaningful use? That's a huge, huge issue. Not only that, the other issue that I mentioned, which is the fact that they can't count depreciated costs. So if they're in the case of critical access hospitals, so if they've already done it, they don't get credit for that when their incentives start. Now, there is concern about rural. Dr. Wakefield and HRSA has really been great on this issue. I know that HRSA has been talking a lot to the Office of National Coordinator, has gotten the policy committee of the Office of National Coordinator to back off a little bit on those critical access hospital requirements to get them another 2 years. So it's kind of a it's too hard to explain, but basically they have more time than I just described to sort of get their act together. That's one of many considerations that are going to happen as this goes along and gets implemented. But everybody's just trying to feeling their way through it right now.
Thank you.
Yes, Gary Feilerman, Atlas Research. I would like to take us back to your dialogue about the dentist and also relate, I think, to some research that Keith has done that shows I think there's 1,000 counties in the United States that don't have a pharmacist, something like that. You know, you can invest in all this equipment, but if there's nobody there, it's a rather useless exercise. And the dentist discussion brings us, I think, face-to-face with the question of scope of practice. And I'm wondering if, in the context of healthcare reform and the rural conundrum, if you will, anybody is dealing with the fact that this artificial system of barriers and constraints on individuals practicing up to their competence has been addressed or will be addressed, because I think it's the only path we've got to rationalize workforce use in rural areas.
I can speak to that a little bit, Gary. It is in some of our panel documents. One of our statements is that we should be working toward policy that has all of our professionals practicing as, I'm not sure I'm using the same language you did, but to their optimum capacity in their practice. And that does, it's a general statement because this issue is fraught with variability across 50 states, because that's where the scope of practice regulations are written and enforced. But implied in my earlier comment about looking at different modalities for the delivery of services is the use to the fullest capacity, as you put it, of all of the professionals. So to use pharmacy as an example, it might not be practical in the future to have the same number of local independently owned pharmacies as we had 10 or 15 years ago. Hopefully we'll sustain a lot of what we have right now, and that's the purpose for some of our research activity. But it doesn't mean that those places have to be without pharmaceutical services. If you were to utilize a pharmacy technician in that community connected through telecommunications to a pharmacist in a different community and use an automatic dispensing machine at the ultimate site in the local community, you can obtain pharmaceutical services from a trained pharmacist to do things that, such as look at drug-drug interaction and utilize the services of the pharmacy technician in the local community to actually do the drug administration on site. Those are the kinds of examples we need to be looking for, and we probably have many of them in place. The Dakotas, for example, are way ahead in terms of using telepharmacy to reach some of those remote, small population, under 2,500 communities across their state.
Got a question for Dr. Irons. You mentioned the importance of tying health to social services, education, et cetera, to address all of the social determinants of health. What have you done, or what do you see as the next step in involving others, like schools, like grocery stores, in improving the health in rural areas?
We've gotten fairly far along with schools. Although they're not at the table in this particular consortium, you've just made me realize that they need to be. So they will be next time. But we're very actively involved with them, and they're actually represented through our school nurses. We have a coordinated school nurse program that happened to originally get funded through our hospital and medical center, and therefore we were able to get a sort of central coordination of what goes on in the schools. It allowed us to extend the reach of our nurse case managers via school nurses into the schools. But obviously, a much bigger challenge is using the educational process to change, using the opportunities for physical education exposure to change children's lives as well, using the schools as places, as venues in which you can reach community when the only thing that's there is a school, as it might be in North Ridge High School in northern Beaufort County, North Carolina, for example, where there's just nothing there but the school. You could use the school in some way. Then you get into the private community, grocers, and I thought that was a really good example. What else is there? Well, in North Carolina, that would be the Food Line. Food Lion, we just say line down there. But that would be the Food Lion, a place where also we could – I hadn't even thought about it. So, great idea. Thanks.
A lot of cross-fertilization going on here today. Question for Keith Mueller. How might critical access hospitals be affected by health care reform in general and by Medicare payment reforms specifically after 2010?
Affected in general, certainly, again, because their emergency departments might be the primary source of access now for persons without insurance, and they have, therefore, the uncompensated care burden. But in most critical access hospitals, not quite large enough to be receiving disproportionate share payments, which is a payment mechanism to help you cover the uncompensated care. On balance, the critical access hospital should come out ahead, if you will, financially by people acquiring insurance who don't have it now. Under the Medicare changes that we might foresee, either as fiscal offsets to the costs that are in the reform legislation or just changes because of the pressure on Medicare, critical access hospitals should be thinking about a couple of things. One is working to maintain their current status, if you will, within the Medicare program of being cost plus 1% reimbursed for the services provided to Medicare patients. As there are increased efforts to change some payment mechanisms, that could come up, and I think that's an important provision for them. And secondly is how they transition some of their work to be participants in, beneficiaries of, changes in fundamental payment, either because of the rise of accountable care organizations, if that catches on as a delivery model, or because of payment tied increasingly to some notion of performance measurement and quality measurement. In a lot of the current legislation, there are exceptions written for critical access and other very small providers. As I read the reform bills, there's a move towards saying everybody is going to come under this tent of some kind of pay for performance using quality measure system. So CAHs need to be thinking about how that would happen in their environment.
Question for you, Tom, and it boils down to this, I guess. How close do you come to meeting the demand that you described, and how close can you come now, in the future, rather, with the current structures and resources?
Well, you'd think we were a long way until you open another door and the place fills up again. The capacity is immediately filled as soon as we open and provide a new service in most areas. So I don't even know if I could say we were a third of the way there overall in the region, maybe more like a quarter of the way there to getting access for people who are under or uninsured, or for those low-income patients on Medicaid who have other compromises that make care inaccessible to them. I can't imagine without a major increase in the number of primary care providers, and I like to use the term more broadly, if we don't have nurse practitioner and PA partners or other partners, we will not make this work. We will not. If we don't have a significant expansion in the number of available providers and in the preparation of those providers to work in places like this, which takes training at the student and the resident level and even after they're in practice, and if we don't have loan forgiveness in place in major ways to help those who have major debt on the average, what's the average, 155,000 right now. Not uncommonly we see 200. We don't have ways for that to work, too. If we don't have ways to make them part of a network of others doing the same kind of work and in a gratifying sort of way, we don't have a chance. That's a long, long-term project. I expect to be dead before it's done. But I do think that we are making progress.
Thanks. And that actually leads to a question that is nominally addressed to Keith, but I welcome responses by you or anyone else, and that is, will health reform, and I guess I would add, should health reform, include possible steps to improve primary care workforce and retention by offering loan forgiveness incentives to newly minted primary care physicians who practice in rural areas?
Yes.
To both, right? Will and should. There are provisions in the House.
Yes, there are provisions in all the legislation that has been marked up by the committees related to workforce in one way or another. The ones that seem to be carrying through into the final bills that will be seen, and I did get a chance to look at the House summary on the way out this morning, do include some expansion in loan repayment provisions with targeted programs for primary care providers. There are also targeted programs in dental and in the nursing profession in the House bill that was introduced yesterday. The incentives are good and good ideas. They need to be as strong as they possibly can given the fiscal environment, because what we're looking at, just to take medicine as an example, are differences in starting income 2- and 3-fold. And so if you're thinking about where you're going to go to residency training and you're looking at a debt burden, as Dr. Iron said, of $150,000 to $200,000, even if you have a predilection to practice in primary care, but you look at the data that says when you come out of residency, your income will be 1/3 that of another profession, and you want to repay your debt as quickly as possible, you're inclined to go into the other profession for financial reasons. The debt loan repayment programs can remove that gap for us. But they need to be as strong as possible, meaning repayment as much as possible, as quickly as possible, so you take away that initial advantage financially of leaving your, again, I'm thinking of the people who are predisposed to go into primary care, leaving that for a different profession because of financial reasons.
I think, in fact, we've got good adverse experience from past loan forgiveness programs in that people, you drag out a little while and then they'll bail on you. You lose them. If it doesn't really look good up front, then it's probably not going to hold them long enough to make them comfortable with that great big debt hanging over their shoulders.
And there are some provisions that that deal with the National Health Service Corps expansions in at least one of the bills that I saw.
Right.
Let me just ask you, as we wind down with our Q&A period, to pull out those blue evaluation forms and fill them out for us. And Neil, you have become popular with these last few cards. One questioner asks if you would talk about any plans for expanding access to the Internet by providers and patients or their families, so that you can enhance information sharing and transferring information?
Well, you know, that's a good question that I don't have the answer to.
And you mentioned before the question of broadband access,
yeah,
which is also
right,
ongoing.
You know, I think that that's going to end up, right or wrong, being less of a federal role and more of a private sector rollout on the part of group, depending on the direction that reform takes as far as consumer provisions go for, you know, accessing health information and that sort of thing. It's going to be the Googles of the world and the Microsofts of the world and the IBMs and the Quests and the Qualcomms, and, you know, they are working to do that because they see collateral markets for their products and services and for new business lines as they do that. There is much less about that in the reform bill, although, or I'm sorry, in the high-tech bill, although the bill talks about empowerment and consumerism and patient protections and that sort of thing. It doesn't really address at least some of the barriers which will continue to exist owing to, you know, the cross-state. When you get down to some of the clinical applications and some of the exchange that is more, has more to do with patient health care and less to do with patient health care information. And so those continue to be major problems, e-prescribing, controlled substances, that sort of thing. We will see more given the earlier provisions in e-prescribing in the Medicare bill from a couple of years ago faster, and there's probably more moving along those lines that is strictly Internet-based and potentially has to do with the patients and the direct consumers than some of these other applications and technologies. Licensure continues to be a huge issue with cross-state licensure, as does credentialing and privileging. The Centers for Medicare Services is trying to undo Joint Commission for Accreditation of Healthcare Organization dictum that says that basically if you're credentialed and privileged in one hospital or healthcare facility for purposes of the telehealth network, you're deemed to be credentialed and privileged in all of your facilities within that network. And that's been longstanding practice for several years once ATA and we were able to finally get that termination. CMS for the last year and a half has said, no, you've got to be credentialed in each of those locations. Well, that's a step backwards in the whole thing about licensing and credentialing and privileging. And it stands to stop a lot of the telehealth programs dead in the tracks, many of them Internet-based.
And what's the rationale? And I would invite any of our colleagues in the audience from CMS to answer that question.
Gary's here from ATA and can probably talk more about it. I think it's a quality, you know, it's stated as a quality concern, you know, that that each of those, but in fact, these are folks who routinely ride circuit or practice between and among all of those same facilities, and it is their network, it is their facilities, it is their colleagues with whom they're doing telehealth consults and things with. So we see we see some steps backward in terms of regulatory kinds of things that would otherwise, you know, after all these years and making it that much more difficult. The other issue are privacy and security concerns as it relates to Internet-based healthcare information, access control, authentication, disclosures, breaches, that sort of thing. And those continue to be issues that cause folks to have a hands-off attitude towards it. Having said all that, there are an awful lot of websites, and the Internet is still most used after one other illicit activity for healthcare kinds of information and access and things.
Let me just use the other question on the card to follow up on that, whether any of those shortcomings that you've described are dealt with, or are there other provisions in the reform bills that are going to affect HIT implementation?
Yeah, there are. We're hoping to have that issue resolved in the reform bill, the one I just mentioned by CMS, and there is potential amendments pending along those lines to deal with that. There are issues that would also be dealt with having to do with store and forward to move them beyond some of the limited demonstrations that otherwise exist in places like Alaska and Hawaii to include FQHCs and Indian Health Service sites in both rural and urban areas. And there are provisions that would, in telehealth, redo the definition of rural for purposes of telehealth somewhat to include some of the isolated areas and otherwise metropolitan areas, because we see that also as a big problem. Because the view of ATA, for example, the American Telemedicine Association, is that telehealth and these technologies should be available rural and urban, and we should stop making those artificial distinctions anymore, given what the technology enables us to do. There are a lot of other provisions, but not so much on the issue we were just discussing.
Okay. Very good. Well, I think we've gotten a pretty rich and wide discussion of a number of issues in this. I give Keith Mueller and Tom Irons a chance to make one last offering of advice to people who are working on this legislation to either get rid of or hang on to a particular provision or move into a different area that they haven't
dealt with as we move down to what may be the final stages. You want to give them a piece of advice? Give them a piece of your mind, Keith?
The one thing that I would close with would be looking at access in rural areas from two perspectives. One, will there be affordable plans with a mechanism for the residents of that area to understand what those plans are and enroll in the plan of their choice? And second, will there be access to local providers for essential services, including those having those providers in the networks that the plans are offering to the rural residents?
Well put. That's exactly what I would want to say.
There you have it, a two-item agenda for those of you who are working on this. Thank you for your attention. This is a timely and useful discussion. I want to thank Brian and his colleagues at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for their participation. Thank the Alliance staff for making it all easy up here and run smoothly. And ask you to join me in thanking the panel for a really useful discussion.